Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens here, where we live, learn, work, and play. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
Hello and welcome to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, they're already tearing down buildings in Fresno to make way for the first stretch of California's high-speed train. But the debate rages on, and beyond the politics, much of it centers on just what will the future of the San Joaquin Valley look like. We'll get two opposing views on the matter from Fresno County Supervisor Debbie Puchigian and from Atlantic columnist James Fallows, who is writing a series of pieces about the train for his American Futures project. Later in the show, we'll talk to NPR's food and agriculture correspondent Dan Charles about what he calls the paradox of the Foster Farms salmonella outbreak. At the same time the company is recalling tainted chicken, the USDA says it's becoming one of the nation's cleanest poultry producers. But our cover story today takes us to Merced County and the former Castle Air Force Base. From the 60s through the 80s, if you drove through Atwater on Highway 99, it was nearly impossible to miss the sights and sounds of the B-52 bombers that called Castle home. All that ended when the base closed in 1995, an event which put a major dent in the area's economy. But now something interesting is going on, both in Atwater and throughout the valley. In the first part of a two-week series, FM89's Ezra David Romero reports on what some are calling a high-tech boom in a region that's known more for its farms and dairies than for its technological advances.
Meet a guy who wakes up and spends his entire day with Google.
Daniel Galindo, I'm a student at the Merced JC.
This 22-year-old won't label himself as a nerd or a techie. He doesn't have a programming degree or write code.
I use Google for research, for homework, class projects, also my phone powered by Google as well as an Android phone. So
he's a millennial, and he says that's enough. That's why when I asked him if he wanted to come with me to spy on a project Google is working on, he looked up from his phone.
I think it'd be cool to see what they're actually doing in person.
But Google's super secret. We asked Google for an interview, but they didn't want to talk.
Ah, we're here.
A 6-foot-tall chain-link fence covered in green canvas hides where the tech company is testing at the historic Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, now called Castle Commerce Center. To the eye, the Cold War relic of a base looks dreary, weed-ridden, and sort of run down. But carved out in pockets of the 2,700 acres of runway and office park are companies using surprisingly advanced technology. We'll start with Google and the driverless car.
So we're here behind the fence, basically at Google. What are you seeing?
They're using the old parking lot around the dormitories with new stoplights put in to test these cars, and we've been seeing a black car with one or two people that are talking into something driving around the track.
He's not the only one excited about Google's presence in the valley. Brendan Smith is a mechanical engineering PhD student at the UC Merced Extension campus at Castle. He peers over Google's fence daily.
I was looking over the fence, and you could see the Lexus autonomous vehicle with the LiDAR unit on the top, which allows it to basically see its surroundings. And you can see the Prius crossing across the intersection as the autonomous vehicle waited.
Smith is also in tech. He flies drones less than 1,000 feet away from the autonomous car. He's part of a 40-man team at UC Merced building data drones. His PhD project is wrapped in blue styrofoam and is called a water drone.
The mission right now is to collect water samples. We can get a pretty good approximation of the number of species that are in that area and what type of species are in that area.
But the driverless car and water-collecting drones are only two things on the list of technological innovation at Castle. Giant cranes, prosthetic limbs, a robotics group, and a balloon-based internet system via Google's Project Loon are just a few.
I understand that there's also rockets being built here.
There are, down the road.
So down Ammo Road.
Yeah. We have a company called Ventions. They're a San Francisco company, and they make small rocket motors, essentially, for things like satellites and so on and so forth.
That's Scott Malta, the airport manager. He served at the base at 17, got married there, and later became a flight instructor in the 80s. He remembers what life was like when the base was full of pilots and planes.
If you transform back to the Air Force days, when money was kind of unlimited, manpower was kind of unlimited, you know, you never saw grass in cracks, you never saw dry ground. This place was a show place.
The bay shut down in 1995 and sat largely dormant until 2006 when Merced County bought it and began looking for renters. I asked Matt Honan, a senior writer with Wired magazine, why such diverse tech companies are making their way to Merced County.
Central California isn't Mountain View or Silicon Valley. Why do you think tech would boom here?
It doesn't have that population concentration that you've got in the Bay Area. And to some extent, companies like to test things in the United States because it's cheaper. That might simulate things they're going to see outside of Silicon Valley. If you're trying to set something up just for Silicon Valley, just for Mountain View, just for San Francisco, it's not going to be highly relevant to a lot of people throughout the country and the world.
And that's exactly why Merced County leaders want to attract companies like Google to Castle. Mark Hendrickson is the director of community and economic development for the county.
Becoming a success in the future is thinking bigger, it's thinking brighter, it's thinking Google.
But until then, Hendrickson and his team are on the prowl to attract other companies like Google to Merced County. Reporting from the old Castle Air Force Base, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And Ezra joins us now in our studio. Ezra, exactly how did Google come to Merced County to Atwater in the first place?
Well, Google originally called Merced County, a guy named Mark Hendrickson, who's in charge of Castle Air Force Base, and said, "Hi, we're X and X company."
So they didn't say, "We're Google."
They gave another name, and it wasn't until multiple phone calls later that they revealed themselves as Google.
And this was late last year.
Late last year that all this happened. And, you know, Mark Hendrickson ended up talking to Google. He went to Google. They came here. He said they were like, they just look like normal young people, you know, young, smart kids.
Very interesting indeed. Now, as you mentioned in your report, we reached out to Google to participate in this story, inviting them to participate, but they declined. What did the company say? Why do you think they were hesitant to talk about this?
Well, you know, I had a long email conversation in the past few months trying to get an interview to drive with the person who drives the autonomous driverless car. And they just said no and no with a PR person as well. And, you know, I think they said no because they don't want to have people think that Google is Merced when what they're doing is they're just testing something in Merced.
They want to keep their brand as being
Silicon
Valley.
Yeah, they want their brand in Silicon Valley and Mountain View and not Merced County and the San Joaquin Valley.
So one last thing. You mentioned rockets. What's going on with rockets at the base?
Well, it's on Ammo Avenue, and there's a company called Ventions, and they're making rocket pieces for a San Francisco-based company. So the motors and things like that.
It's a fascinating story and quite the change from the old days of the base and quite the change from when the base was largely silent. Again, Ezra, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
This is Valley Edition. It's been over 6 months since the new federal health law opened up coverage for millions of Americans. But in counties throughout California, thousands of Medi-Cal applicants are waiting months just to find out if they're eligible for the program. FM89's Diana Aguilera reports from Clovis on how one young couple is caught in the backlog.
Paola Martinez and her husband, Irving Toscano, thought they had done everything right to get health care coverage. They made sure they met the Medi-Cal eligibility requirements, they filled out the paperwork, and signed up through the Covered California website at the end of March. But ever since then, they've been waiting.
As time passed, it was from excited, like, yay, we're going to be covered, to like, what the heck, when are we going to be covered?
The young couple is not alone. As of last week, there were still more than 11,000 people in Fresno County waiting to hear the status of their Medi-Cal applications. 2 weeks ago, Toscano thought his wait might finally be over when he received a letter from the county. The news? His application still hadn't been processed. He says it's frustrating.
All right, I just keep waiting then. All I could do is wait.
The expansion of coverage under the Affordable Care Act was meant to help people like Toscano and Martinez. The couple has a limited income and would seem to meet the requirements for Medi-Cal. He works as a security guard and she's unemployed. For the past 3 years, they've been living at his parents' house in Clovis. Norman Williams, a spokesman for the state's Department of Healthcare Services, says that statewide there's about 600,000 people like Toscano and Martinez whose applications are still pending.
We enroll people into coverage each day and more people apply each day.
So what's causing this backlog? Deborah Martinez with Fresno County's Department of Social Services says there's two main factors. First, when enrollment opened, the state's computer systems didn't communicate properly with the county's computers.
It was meant to be, let's say, instantaneous, and it hasn't been instantaneous at all.
She says that stalled the approval process and helped create the backlog. The other reason? Fresno County has been flooded with applicants. That's put a strain on resources both at the county and the state. Still, Martina says the process is now running much more smoothly than it was months ago.
It's a very comprehensive and detailed process, but I think we are like 20 times better than we were in January.
She says as of last week, the county approved about 64,000 Medi-Cal applications. And Williams says things are also improving statewide.
The 600,000 is a considerable decrease since the roughly 900,000 who were pending at the end of March.
But if things are looking a lot better, why is the backlog still a problem? Well, unlike Covered California, the state's health insurance exchange, where the sign-up deadline was March 31st, Medi-Cal accepts enrollments year-round. And that means as applications submitted earlier in the year are being finalized, new ones are coming in, adding to the backlog.
Applications are being taken by the date that they were submitted. So our eligibility workers know to look at the date of application and work those first.
That comes as little consolation to Toscano and his wife, Martinez. They say it's been a troubling process, and if a health emergency were to happen, they're not sure where to turn for help or how they'd pay for it.
In a serious case, I will have to go to the emergency and find a way how to pay my bills later on. I don't have any money saved up for any of those kind of bills.
Back at Toscano's home in Clovis, they're getting ready to fire up the grill for dinner. The family's cooking steak fajitas while Toscano and his wife play with their little nephew, Elias, who likes to honk the horn of his toy car. It's a happy time for the young couple, but concern about their health care looms large.
That makes me nervous because what if we don't get covered? And what are we going to do? Hopefully we do because we need it. Everyone needs it.
With any luck, their wait may soon be over. County officials say they've made tremendous progress in processing Medi-Cal applications and expect to eliminate the backlog by September 1st. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Bianna Aguilera.
You're listening to Valley Edition. California's ambitious plan to link the Central Valley with L.A. and the Bay Area through a high-speed train is one step closer to becoming reality this week. Demolitions in preparation for construction began yesterday in Fresno. That doesn't mean the bullet train is a done deal, however. In a moment, we'll get two different perspectives on the train, from Fresno County Supervisor Debbie Puchigian, who is asking the Board of Supervisors today to formally oppose high-speed rail, and from Atlantic Magazine columnist James Fallows, who argues that the train, while expensive, could help transform the Central Valley and actually preserve farmland. But first, FM89's Ezra David Romero brings us this report from near Fresno's Chaffee Zoo, where the sounds of construction are already underway.
The jaws of a giant excavator tore through the old Annie's Hollywood Inn Bar in West Fresno Monday morning.
That excavator right there is just going to hit probably the backside of that building because it's so small, it's not going to take long. Probably if we blink, it'll be down in 5 minutes.
That's Jill Croker with J. Croker Incorporated. The 66-year-old bar is the first of many buildings to be reduced to smithereens as part of construction along the first 29-mile segment of California high-speed rail. Diana Gomez is the Central Valley Regional Director for the Rail Authority.
Throughout the week, we'll be demolitioning up to 5 buildings this week, and we hope for that to continue. We've acquired over 40 parcels, so we're clearing the right-of-way so they can start construction.
Three homes, the Old Horn Photo Building, and the former Del Monte Packing House are slated to come down as well.
They're going to knock it all down so the building's all collapsed on itself, the center pile. Then they'll be loaded up onto a truck, and then it'll be taken to a landfill where it'll be mostly recycled.
And then press repeat. Croker's company is contracted out for all the demolition along the Fresno-Madera corridor.
We've waited so long to do this and been in so many meetings and around so many tables. It's kind of excited to finally get our boots on the ground and get this thing off the ground and get going.
Croker hopes high-speed rail keeps her busy for the next 2 years. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
But while building demolitions are already underway as part of the high-speed rail project, the massive rail line is anything but a settled matter. The project has inspired vigorous opposition from valley farmers and business owners, whose operations lie in the path of the train. It's also become a political football as well. This morning, the Fresno County Board of Supervisors will debate a proposal from Supervisor Debbie Puchigian to formally oppose the project. Yesterday afternoon, I had a chance to talk to Supervisor Puchigian about this issue. Supervisor Puchigian, welcome to Valley Edition.
Oh, thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Clearly, the issue of high-speed rail is of great importance to the county and to residents in your district and all the other districts in the county. But the county doesn't actually have a say in whether this project moves forward or not, or how it moves forward. Why are you bringing this to the board today?
We don't have an official say. That's up to the governor, the legislature, and the authority, the high-speed rail authority. But, you know, I think we have an opinion, and I think that it's in our purview to share our opinion, and we have concerns, and we've had concerns for the last 5 or 6 years, and it's just kind of come to a head, Joe.
Why now?
You know, I think they're moving forward. They're getting closer to maybe acquiring property. I don't think they really have acquired much property up to this point. And it, you know, I think we've been patient. We've given them 6 years to put together a viable plan. We've given them 6 years to secure funding. And, you know, I just think now is the time to say, you know, it might be time to just cut our losses and use this money, reappropriate it someplace else, and use it for other things, water, already existing transportation infrastructure, education, public safety, for other things that maybe are higher priority to a lot of Californians.
I think if you talk to a lot of people, even those who may be supporters of this project, they would point out that it has perhaps not been executed flawlessly or far from flawlessly. But is there anything that you think, you know, if they had done this differently, I might be on the other side, or I might be able to at least have a limited amount of support for this project?
Yes. There are several things, Joe. First of all, you know, this was an initiative. It was a voter initiative, Prop 1A in 2008. It went to the voters. It narrowly passed by 48 statewide. And in the initiative language said that the price tag would be $33 billion. The initiative language said that the trains from San Francisco to L.A., it would be about a 2-hour and 40-minute ride. The initiative language said that the approximate fare would be $50. The initiative language said that there was a completion date of 2020, and it also said that there would be private funding and no subsidies. Now, if all that were true, if all those promises made to get the voters of California to vote for this initiative, if all those were true, I don't think we'd be sitting here today. I don't think we would be sitting here asking members of the Board of Supervisors to oppose the project. The problem is, Joe, that promises were made to get the voters to vote for this, and none of those promises have been kept. And I think the taxpayers, I really think the taxpayers, again, I will say they've been very patient, and they've had plenty of time to make their case. They've had plenty of time to come up with a viable plan. They've had plenty of time to secure funding, and they've had plenty of time to keep the promises made to the voters who supported this in the first place. And none of that has been done.
Incoming Senate President Kevin De Leon made
Yes.
some comments about the Central Valley and about high-speed rail, and he would like to see the money that voters set aside for high-speed rail spent in his area in Southern California to improve the existing rail infrastructure there as the initial step. And he said, the Central Valley, why build it there? There's nothing but tumbleweeds there. What did you think about that?
Well, I thought his comments about the valley were somewhat disrespectful, but I did think he was right on as far as when the initiative had San Francisco to LA, we anticipated moving this million people to that million people, not taking a detour through the valley. The ridership in the valley, where the poorest community around. And, you know, now we've learned that, you know, ticket prices are not going to be $50. And, you know, I think the ridership will be down. It's taken this detour that is costing a lot more money. And I think he's right on the issue, but I think the comments about the Valley were slightly disrespectful.
Before we go, one final question, kind of dovetailing off of what you were just talking about there and the economic challenges this region faces. A lot of people who are supporters of high-speed rail talk about this as a potential game changer to diversify the Valley's economy, to better link residents in Bakersfield or Fresno or Merced County to the Bay Area, to Southern California, so where people could live here in the Valley and commute to work in those places and bring build the Valley's tax base and things there. Do you feel that this is a potential threat to the Valley's ag economy? And is it also important to diversify by looking at things like how to better connect the different parts of the state?
Well, you know, we are an ag county. We've been an ag county for over 100 years. We've been an ag county for many, many years. Now, there are a lot of people around that are embarrassed that we are an ag county, but they really ought to hope that we stay an ag county, because if they plan on continuing to eat and continuing to allow us to feed the world, then, you know, we are an ag county. There isn't soil like this anyplace else on the planet.
But could the county evolve on two tracks, pardon the pun, to diversify its base more?
Well, I think we always want to diversify. I mean, there's areas of this county, you know, we've got a technology park here. We have, and there's always room for diversification. But, you know, are we going to ruin what we have? And I'm very, very concerned that it's not going to happen. And they're going to ruin what we have. And as we're feeding the rest of the world, you know, they're taking away some of that opportunity. And, you know, we do have a poor economy. We do have our area is one of the poorest. And would someone live here and maybe take a high-speed rail train to San Francisco and work? Yeah, maybe they would. If they like 109-degree weather and 17 degrees in the winter, yeah, maybe they would. There would be some. But I just have the concern that their job numbers are inflated. There's just a lot of concerns right now. And I just think that it's something for our board. You know, the last time we took an official position on the project was back in 2007. We have two new board members since 2007. And you know what? We're always up for a good discussion, and so I think that's what it will be.
Definitely think there will be one of those happening at the Board of Supervisors Tuesday morning. Again, Fresno County Supervisor Debbie Puchigian joining us today, talking about her proposal that would formally put the County of Fresno on the record as opposing the high-speed rail project as it exists right now. Supervisor Puchigian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Now for another perspective on high-speed rail, we're joined by James Fallows, a national correspondent for The Atlantic. Over the past week, he's authored several pieces about the project as part of his American Futures initiative online at theatlantic.com. James Fallows, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thanks. It's nice to talk to you.
Your project has taken you to just about every corner of the country, and now you're writing about high-speed rail and visiting Central California. You were here a few months ago in Fresno and other places throughout the Valley. Why write about this project, and why is it important for a national audience?
I think it's important for a national audience because there is an imbalance in east-west coverage. I'm originally from Southern California. I grew up in Redlands, which is out near San Bernardino in the Inland Empire. And one of the sort of the struggles of my life has been recognizing the national media in which I work are based on the East Coast. But our most populous state, our most economically productive state, gets undercovered in national coverage. So I thought that if the high-speed rail debate were happening along the East Coast corridor between, say, Atlanta and D.C. or something, it would be dominant news. It's a very important project. Whether or not you support it, and I do on balance support it, I think it's one of great consequence and deserves more attention than it's gotten outside the state.
You've compared it to the Transcontinental Railroad, the Erie Canal, in terms of its potential significance. I was reading Stephen Ambrose's wonderful book, Nothing Like It in the World, about the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. That, too, was a project fraught with cost overruns, corruption scandals, mismanagement, political intrigue. How do you think it compares to something like those massive projects?
There are two important realities about any big infrastructure project, even casting that as broadly as the Louisiana Purchase or the Alaska Purchase in the 1800s, which really made America. Certainly the Transcontinental Railroad, the construction of the Golden Gate Bridge, basically any large measure that any democracy has undertaken, two things that have been true. One is that these have always been controversial. Even the Louisiana Purchase, you know, believe it or not, was bitterly criticized at the time. And it's because anything large really does necessarily involve trade-offs and imperfections, and anything involving construction always has there's a possibility for leakage. The other thing that I assert to be true is that usually these things end up having benefits, more benefits that aren't foreseen than drawbacks that aren't foreseen. You know, the dynamic effects of railroads or airports or the Golden Gate Bridge or Louisiana, it is harder, I think it's easier to foresee in the here and now the inconveniences they cause than to imagine 20 or 50 or 100 years from now the sorts of dynamic effects they have. So I, in general, have a bias in favor of these projects because, to me, the historical record suggests that we overemphasize their drawbacks and underimagine their benefits.
You write that you came into this reporting journey generally in support of high-speed rail, and after studying the issue, talking to a lot of people, looking at a lot of reports and studies on the project, you say you're actually now more in support of the project. Why is that?
Yes, and so I'll explain first my starting point and then my evolution. My starting point is I've spent a lot of my life reporting from outside the United States. I lived in China for a long time and Japan and other parts of Africa and Europe. And there you see the transforming effect of some of these big projects. We wouldn't want to make these decisions the way the Chinese do, of just bulldozing people out of the way, literally, and all the rest. But you can see the difference that this good infrastructure makes. And if you've been in a place where high-speed rail works, it just is a whole different experience. So I was predisposed to think that if there's a way this can work for California, it's that's worth looking for. As I don't present myself as being a original expert on this. I'm still in the process of interviewing people, but it has seemed to me the most powerful argument is the dynamic one, that if California does not do this, and there are another 10 or 15 million people there over the next generation, the other ways of dealing with the transportation problems, whether it's more roads or just the cost of congestion or more airports or whatever, will be more destructive, as far as I can tell, than going ahead with the rail project.
The challenges of this project and its implementation have been very well documented throughout the media on our station and beyond. Cost overruns, a business plan that has been revised and revised again and revised again, construction delays, legal challenges. One of your critics said something to the effect that if the people at the Rail Authority wanted this project to fail, they couldn't be doing a better job. Can something like this survive what appears to be, at least at the very best, a poorly executed rollout? Can it survive?
I guess we'll see. That's up to the people of my original home state, your current home state. I thought it was interesting. I posted that criticism and also the response from Dan Richard, who, of course, is now head of the High-Speed Rail Authority, who said he made two points. One is he admitted that there had been lots of the problems that the correspondent was mentioning, but he said that with Governor Brown taking it more seriously than his predecessors had, he felt Dan Richard alleged or asserted that it was on a different management track, and he had some evidence to back that up. He also pointed out that BART itself, where he was twice the president of the BART board, was at least as imperiled when it was getting going now 50 years ago, when BART was getting started. And again, BART has its problems, I know, as a former writer, but if you imagine Bay Area transport without it, you have a more depressing prospect. So I can't predict as a political reality how this is going to go. My judgment as a political observer is that I hope it goes forward just as a past and I hope future resident of California. I think it'll be better for the state than the alternatives.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has a new series of articles online at theatlantic.com about California's high-speed rail project. A lot of the most strident opposition to this project, at least here in Central California, comes from local farmers and dairymen who say the rail line is going to destroy their business by slicing their properties in half. They say this project will destroy their way of life, yet you point to some research that you say shows high-speed rail, if done correctly, could actually save farms and farmland here in the Central Valley. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes, and again, in my role as reporter rather than original expert here, by talking to people at UC Davis, where a lot of this research has been going on, they're saying that obviously we know that over the last century and over the last generation, farmland in the Central Valley and elsewhere has been chewed up at a ferocious rate. People around Fresno know that as well as anybody else in the state. In my hometown of Redlands, I've seen orange groves give way to development. That land has been chewed up not because of high-speed rail, which hasn't existed, but because of all the other forces we're well aware of in California's development, from suburbanization to freeway development to sprawl of all kinds. The analysis that the people who seem most convincing to me make is that if we look 20 years ahead, 50 years ahead, the land that is likely to be lost in farms because of high-speed rail will probably be much less than the land that would be lost without high-speed rail. If there is more highway construction, if the current sprawl dynamics continue. So they may be wrong in that analysis, but at least they're saying on a dynamic basis, if we look to the California that our children and grandchildren will know, it's likely to be less chewed up if this project goes ahead than otherwise.
There's also a tension here in Central California between urban and rural. We see it in a lot of different issues, and I think we see it here as well. Opponents say that they want this area to stay the same, to remain a largely agricultural area. But others say that our social problems here, the high unemployment, poverty, things like air pollution, all of these problems make staying the same unacceptable. And they cite high-speed rail as a possible solution. Do you see that tension in your travels here as well?
Sure, and that's a tension that is certainly present in California, but is not unique to California. This is a worldwide issue. If you travel in parts of France or Italy or even Germany, people simultaneously want to preserve those areas as having all the virtues which have made them so appealing over the centuries, and yet how are people going to have jobs there, and how are the schools going to be financed and all that. Same thing is happening even in China, where I've been living, where parts of rural China don't want to be paved over the way Beijing and Shanghai are, but they also want to have some of the benefits of prosperity. So this is the California instance of a worldwide tension, and something for which no one has an actual clear balance. I think that clear answer. I think the California message over the decades has been situations or circumstances that allow the entire state economy to develop in its educational aspects and its high-tech aspects and its agricultural business and all the rest, and try to preserve the circumstances that make each of them special, will provide the rising tide for the state as a whole. The people in the Central Valley will probably be better off if the state as a whole becomes more prosperous, has more money for schools, anti-pollution, et cetera, et cetera. The question then is, what's the way to best manage this very, very complex equation? I think further freeways through the valley and further sprawl in the valley are probably the worst answer to that. And the question is, what are better answers than that?
Some people talk about California and say the state has been in decline for some time now. It used to be in the 50s, 60s, and into the early 70s that the state was known for thinking big, for its big projects, not only for things like the aerospace industry in Hollywood, but for things like the water projects, the creation of the CSU and UC systems, the freeway system. It's been a while since California undertook anything even remotely close to the scale of high-speed rail. It was before we had the state's landmark environmental law. Can California still think this big on this grand of a scale?
One reason I'm proud to be originally a Californian and still think of myself that way is that California is the distillation of the American experience, but in a way people don't usually think. We usually think, oh, the styles start there, music or clothes or tech or whatever. I think it's actually the paradox of modern America. The paradox of modern America is we have, in my view, by far the most creative economy on earth, by far the most new opportunities for people. Immigrants come from all over the place. And the problem we have is on public issues, public governance, being able to resolve disagreements and invest in anything that it requires a public presence. California has had the same situation over the last generation plus. When I was a kid in Redland schools in the 1960s, they were very well funded. That's less the case now. California is privately still enormously powerful. Look at the tech industry, the entertainment industry, the agricultural industry. The public realm has been the one with the challenges, and I actually think that it's good that Jerry Brown, in his second incarnation, is pushing rail as a big public thing that would have benefits for the state in the long run. But that's my personal view.
Before we go, one last question. You've been traveling throughout California, throughout the Central Valley as well. You were here in Fresno a couple of months ago and talking to folks at a restaurant downtown and trying to get the feel for the community. Maybe what surprised you or what didn't you expect to find in throughout your travels here in Central California?
So I'm about to start writing a series of articles about a place called Winters up near Davis, which is a walnut and almond community and the way they're trying to deal with environmental circumstances. I guess in the time since I was living in California, I'm newly impressed in the contrast, the wealth and poverty contrast between coastal California and Valley California. And I think that is something which I'd known in concept but hadn't sort of reabsorbed in real experience until sort of driving up and down the valley recently. So I'm going to be out, my wife and I will be out there again soon. We're going to come back to Fresno. We were only there for a day plus before, so we'll be back there for a number of days and talk with you to try to learn about your particular city, which is interesting to us.
Well, it's very interesting. It's all available online at theatlantic.com as part of the American Futures Project. We've been talking with James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for giving me the time.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment for more on Valley Edition and the controversy that's brewing over water rates in the city of Fresno. It could be headed to voters in November. We'll find out in just a few days. FM89's Carrie Klein reports coming up on Valley Edition. To Valley Edition. There's been a lot of news lately about the way money and politics interact and wind up influencing our system of governance. In today's edition of the commentary series The Moral Is, Fresno State business law professor Ida Jones says democracy works best when persons vote with their ballots and not when corporations vote with their money.
Can a corporation breathe fresh or polluted air, read a good book, or go to the movies? Can a corporation take care of feeding, clothing, and educating a child? Can it fill out a ballot for a candidate? Of course not. Although we know that a corporation doesn't have these essential qualities of human beings, the Supreme Court has decided differently. It has decided that corporate persons should be extended the same rights as natural human beings. That completely ignores the fundamental differences between a legally created entity and a natural person. Now, what a corporate person can do, though, is use its influence, that is, its money, to affect which laws are adopted. Corporations can use their money to help elect legislators who are beholden to the corporations. They can use their money to lobby for laws that support corporate positions on issues that matter to the corporations, even if those positions are harmful to natural persons. On the other hand, natural persons, except for the very wealthy, don't have the kind of money that can influence elections. Thus, natural persons are at a disadvantage to find legal solutions for issues that impact us as human beings. What an irony. In response to those concerns, on June 23, 2014, the California legislature joined Vermont and passed Assembly Joint Resolution 1, AJR1, an application to the United States Congress to call a constitutional convention that would limit corporate personhood for purposes of campaign finance and political speech, and that would further declare that money does not constitute speech and may be legislatively limited. This resolution is a first step toward preventing the corruption that occurs when money controls politics. The California resolution clearly states that corporate personhood exists only for those rights that the legislature specifically grants. Democracy, the right to vote and personhood, have as their foundation individuals, that is, natural persons participating. Natural persons have characteristics, including mortality, that corporations don't. The California resolution specifically rejects the Supreme Court's ruling in the Hobby Lobby case that corporations are persons. California's passage of AJR1 is a victory for democracy because it allows democracy to operate by being responsive to individual, that is, human voters. Those voters can elect candidates that are not beholden to corporations, but instead to the people who voted for them. Statewide, less than 26% of voters even vote in primary or mid-year elections. That's in part because many say their vote doesn't matter, because those with the deepest pockets, those with the most money, can influence both who is elected and whose interests new laws support. Under the current system, corporate money discourages voters. This resolution, if it results in a constitutional amendment, would change that. I am proud of this state, which was willing to vote to return governance to the people. I look forward to 32 other states joining California and Vermont. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
The Moral is a production of the Bonner Center for Character Education at Fresno State and Valley Public Radio. The views expressed on the program are those of the commentator and not necessarily those of the station or the institute. You can find more commentaries on our website at kvpr.org. You're listening to Valley Edition. Ask any scientist and they'll tell you that oil and water don't mix. The same can't be said about politics and water, especially in a drought. And as FM89's Carrie Klein reports, Fresno voters could soon get a chance to weigh in on a pricey water issue at the ballot box.
A grassroots campaign to roll back a planned water rate hike that then sparked a lengthy legal battle could soon wind up before Fresno voters. On Thursday, the Fresno City Council will decide whether to put a referendum called Measure W on the November ballot or to repeal the water rate plan. The move comes after a citizens group announced last week that its petition drive has collected over 5,500 valid signatures, more than enough to qualify for the ballot. The plan involves incrementally raising monthly water bills in order to pay for an upgrade to the city's water system. Mark Standriff is a spokesperson for the city of Fresno.
This entire plan was the undertaking of a program to improve our water supply conditions and frankly, to replenish the groundwater that it's rapidly diminishing here in the city of Fresno.
The program includes building a facility to treat river water, as well as upgrading pipes and other infrastructure. The total cost, $410 million. And to pay for it, Fresno residents' water bills would on average double over the span of 3 years. Measure W wants none of it. Doug Vagum, a former Fresno County supervisor, is the loudest voice behind the measure and says the rate increase is unfair.
Most people understand. They feel frustrated. They feel helpless. They don't know what to do. They didn't know where to turn, and they had no choice but to do what they were asked to do, which is pay big high rates and then stop water in their lawns.
Vagum and the proponents of Measure W agree that the city needs a better water system, but they want the money to come from somewhere else.
Do you pay for it only out of the faucet, or do you do what schools do when you build a new building or colleges do when they build campuses? They don't go to the ratepayer. The schools go to the homeowners and the property owners in that case, and the colleges go to endowments.
Measure W proponents also claim that the city didn't properly consult with the public before the water rate decision was made. But Mark Standriff claims there were plenty of mailings and town hall meetings beforehand. The city also claims that under California law, a public vote wasn't legally required.
I think it's important for people to realize that in Prop 218, it actually exempts cities and municipalities from having to hold a public vote if it involves water, sewer, or garbage collection.
The two sides spent much of the past year in court fighting over the rate increase and the ability to move forward with the petition. Now, with enough signatures gathered to qualify for the ballot, the city council faces a situation similar to last year's Measure G. Tom Holyoke is a political science professor at Fresno State. He says the two referendums mark a political shift in the city of Fresno.
We seem to be entering a time when the public is going to essentially have veto power over a lot of the decisions made at the city hall, I guess kind of a plebiscite. That's not always a good thing.
Holyoke says Vagum's campaign could have ramifications beyond water.
Basically, the court has come down and said that this is a right he has, and if it is a right, then he is free to exercise it. I'm sure from the city's point of view, it's a terrible nuisance. In fact, from the city's point of view, it's probably more than just a man who's being a nuisance. This is a potentially big problem, I think, for the city.
Of course, citizens get upset about their government's decisions all the time. That's why they can vote in new candidates at election time. But Holyoke says if voters have direct control over every big decision, they may not always have long-term goals in mind.
If the city has determined the water infrastructure needs to be replaced, then that's almost certainly something that's got to happen and needs to happen in the near future, and that we put ourselves at quite considerable risk if we don't replace our infrastructure.
On July 17th, the Fresno City Council will decide whether to put Measure W on the November ballot or repeal the water rate hikes altogether. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Over the past year, Foster Farms plants in Livingston and Fresno have been dealing with a major salmonella outbreak. Contaminated poultry from the plants has sickened hundreds nationwide, launching an investigation by the USDA and CDC. Officials even shut down the Livingston plant for 10 days this past January after concerns about roaches in the facility. Then just weeks ago, July 3rd, the company issued a recall of chicken products. Here to tell us more about the situation and to give us an interesting perspective on this is NPR's Dan Charles. He covers the food industry and more for NPR and is a contributor to the Salt blog on NPR.org. Dan, welcome.
Nice to be here.
First of all, I want to talk about what's been happening in this facility in the nationwide context. We know that salmonella is a concern at poultry facilities across the country, but Foster Farms, it's been a major issue, has it not?
Well, yeah. This goes back to last fall when there was a salmonella outbreak that the CDC, you know, the CDC calls it an outbreak because they saw sort of commonalities between different salmonella poisoning cases across the country, mostly in California. And by interviewing people about what they'd been eating, they kind of made a link to chicken from Foster Farms. And on top of that, some inspectors went to some plants, Foster Farms plants. This is back in October of last year. And they saw a fair amount of salmonella sort of contamination there, and they threatened to shut down the plants because of that. But, you know, the thing is, you know, apparently, according to various people involved in this case, Foster Farms has really been taking this pretty seriously and has spent a lot of money, tens of millions of dollars, trying to clean up their act, trying to get rid of the salmonella, you know, that's in their operations. And they're now, according to testing, among the best operations in the country.
So tell me more about the recall itself. Exactly what are we talking about here? Is this chicken that was just processed? Is it stuff that was processed months ago?
So the recall is a specific sort of instance where they were able to link a case of salmonella, some products that they found in, you know, somebody's freezer, to a specific lot of chickens that came out of some plants, you know, Foster Farm plants. So that's why up to now there hadn't been a recall, you know, resulting from this outbreak. In this case, they said, okay, this lot of chicken parts from this particular plant, we, you know, had salmonella on it, so we're going to issue this recall. It's actually a fairly narrow date range, and it's, you know, it's stuff that came out of the plant back in March. You know, so in a sense, this is months-old business, the recall is. The outbreak also seems to be sort of petering out a bit. You know, the major bump in cases was last fall. They keep coming, though. You know, so it's this interesting conundrum for Foster Farms. On the one hand, you know, the people in the food safety business, the insiders at USDA, and also some people from academia that they brought in to work with them on this salmonella problem, they think that Foster Farms is kind of, you know, they see Foster Farms as kind of heroes in the industry, feel like they're doing more than anybody else, and then they've pushed the rates of salmonella contamination on chicken parts down to, you know, levels of 2% or so, or less than 5% in any case, where typical in the industry is something like 25%. So you have this, you know, sort of paradox. On the one hand, sort of food safety people say Foster Farms is actually doing a great job. And on the other hand, you know, you've got this continuing outbreak, you have this recall, and they're getting hammered in the press.
Is there any idea of why that might be? Is this a particular strain of salmonella that's especially difficult to deal with?
Well, one reason why the recall happened and why this outbreak, you know, why the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, keeps putting out these updates on the outbreak is this outbreak is identifiable as an outbreak because it is a particular strain of salmonella. It's kind of like it's got a fingerprint. So anytime a case of salmonella shows up and it's got this particular fingerprint, it's associated with this outbreak. And the outbreak in general has been associated with Foster Farms. Even though there are probably cases that are counted as part of this outbreak that actually didn't come from chicken, you know, from Foster Farms. But, you know, they're saying they feel like most of it is. And so that's why Foster Farms is kind of, you know, has this, you know, high profile in the industry. How they'll get over it, you know, it remains to be seen. I mean, they've got the rates of contamination down, apparently, according to testing. Will they ever get to zero? Maybe not. But, you know, I think if this continues, if, you know, and other outbreaks take place with other sources, I think they'll, you know, maybe be credited with more of the progress that they've been making.
We've been talking with NPR's Dan Charles. He covers the food industry for NPR and also contributes to NPR's The Salt blog. You can find him online at npr.org and also our website, kvpr.org. Dan Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
My privilege. Thanks.
Well, that does it for another edition of Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Send us an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org, or if you're on Twitter, you can send us a tweet. We're @KVPR and @Valley Edition. On Facebook as well, Valley Public Radio in the search box brings up our page. We'd love to hear from you. For Valley Public Radio's entire team, Valley Public Radio's producer Ezra David Romero, as well as reporter Carrie Klein and reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. We'll see you next week for another Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.